Intercaustic learning and change facilitator and consultant.
Paradigm about the last 10 years and work almost entirely in the international development sector.
Tony Page, who works sometimes with Vicky on my left, often with Alana on my right. I'm involved with leadership development, sometimes in Africa, sometimes in other countries, and I also work as a facilitator with executive teams.
My name is Alana Friedman, and I'm part of a rather small role. I do leadership work in Africa, and I have a real passion for education, so I'm looking at how we bring leadership into the way, into kind of schools and working with young people and thinking about kind of how do we fundamentally shift systems rather than just tweak them.
Hi, I'm Sandra Hilton, also a consultant partner at Shepherd Moscow. We're out in full force today. We're just embarking really upon learning about complexity theory, so I'm just fascinated to see it from a different angle and to hear about your experiences.
Did you all used to work with Peter Fryer?
Yes,
I did.
That's so.
And Francis Dalton.
Yes.
And I'm Michael Dolan, also at Shepherd Moscow. Just realizing I might have had a different tea break. I did a doctorate up with Ralph Stacey. A different take on complexity again.
Yes.
I'm amazed how much the umbrella complexity actually covers. It's an enormous amount of difference in thinking.
I'm Bill Tate from the Institute for Systemic Leadership.
Hi, I'm Janet Evans. I'm a researcher, worked in the Complex Systems Group at Crown Corporation,
yes.
Professor Peter Allen. I'm working in the field of restorative justice, and I see there are links between restorative justice and complexity.
I'm Vinay Gupta. I do disaster relief, and I'm at the Institute for Security and Resilience Studies at UCL.
Hi, I'm Helen McCrory. I'm probably not going to be that brief, but I knew Eve some years ago, so I've been coming to complexity workshops for some time, so I'm fascinated by the theory. I used to be an organisation development consultant and facilitator, and I've recently taken a proper job again, if that's the right word. I've joined the circus. I now work for an organisation called Circus Space, and we are a circus school who run a BA programme in circus art. And I do something unusual to give a stimulus for reflection as far as leadership is concerned. So we run circus art sessions for leaders and teams so that they can reflect on how to learn, how to face fear, to juggle, etc.
I'm Dan Greenwood. I'm a lecturer at the Department of Politics at University of Westminster. And my research interests are to do with policy making and complexity.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Richard Hare. I'm a knowledge management consultant and internet strategist. I'm currently working with British American Tobacco, and I'm also a member of the Cognitive Edge Network.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Hank Sahota. I'm a director of consulting growth and credit, which is essentially about taking complexity, understanding it,
my name's Ed Rosen, and I'm at the Institute of Leadership and Service Improvement at London South Bank University, which is in the Faculty of Health. And the work I do, one of the reasons for coming along today is I'm working with patients and service users. Many of them have long-term health conditions, and they're being trained and supported to become active learning facilitators to deliver support to other people with long-term health conditions within GP practices with the support of a network of GPs in Lambeth. And as well, I was just reflecting on what I was going to say, is I'm creating a situation where we build the local community capacity by making it as complex as we can get it, because the project's also being supported by the TUC. And I think it's probably one of the very few cases where we've got the TUC and GPs coming together to create a different kind of learning system to support local leaders who are people with long-term health conditions who work alongside GPs as we move into an integrated NHS sometime in the future.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Ed.
My name is Alex Mears, and I also work in the Institute of Leadership and Service Improvement at South Bank. My background is in health service research and psychology.
Thank you.
My name is Hans Einheim. I'm visiting from Norway. I'm an associate professor at Vestfold University College in Norway, but visiting London South Bank University. I was very happy to be able to come and go to this event. I'm working in the promotion, but I'm a trained anthropologist, so I've done my duty and work in development for some years. But now I'm kind of doing educational work in.
Thank you.
My name is Louise Jane
Erling.
I'm currently with Montrose Associates, providing strategic advice and due diligence to large corporates. That follows 10 years in the Foreign Office, then 10 years in the Cabinet Office, which was punctuated by Kennedy School, where I came across the work of James Snowden on complexity and individual exchange things.
Thank you.
My name is Cynthia
Lottley.
I'm a Senior PhD in Complexity. Bringing complexity theory to the international development area after 10 years of experience in international foundations in Latin America. So glad to find some mates in there in Latin America.
Thank you. My name is Greg Fisher. I'm currently setting up a think tank orientated around complexity science, which really is to leverage the sort of complexity community in the UK or globally to address public policy concerns. So if anybody's interested in getting involved
with that, come and talk to me. Hello, my name is Saeed Ashokri. I'm a member of Alice Incompetent Group, also University Associate in Engineering Science and Technology. I'm currently involved in community regeneration and development.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. I think you will agree we have a wonderful mix here today. So, I think it will be important now to start not just perhaps question and answer, but more of a discussion. And I was wondering if anyone had time during the break to actually think about the questions that Lynn had raised and give us any considered thoughts. Lynn, would you like to repeat the questions, please?
How can leaders be supported and encouraged to see and lead their organisations as complex adaptive systems by academics, by consultants? And how can complexity theory be made and used more accessible and usable to more leaders?
Okay, so I would invite you either comments on those questions or questions you may have for either speaker or simply a comment. Yes?
I'll start with a very short one. James Snowden's framework, Connecting, has an impossible to pronounce name and is, you know, simple, complex, complicated, and chaotic. Mm-hmm. Nobody can tell these things apart.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the small contributions we made was renaming this easy, hard, fickle, and borked. And the actual uptake of, which category you're in. So some of this, I think, is about finding much more simple, direct, descriptive language.
Yes.
Because there's a tendency to use, subtle, technical, precise words rather than working through examples, right? It's like the stock market and the weather, or it's like building a rocket. You know, there might be precise shades of meaning that are communicated by using complex language. But if we're trying to push this stuff down from a think tank level and from an academic level into managerial bureaucracy, and if you look at Deming's 14 rules, right? Deming's 14 rules, I think the longest word is seven letters. Drive out fear. It's a very simple commandment. And I think there's a need here for looking at the things which spread through simplicity and trying to find a simple way of explaining complexity in a managerial context.
Yes, I agree with you entirely, actually, because in fact we find that one of the best ways to engage with organisations is to speak with them in the language that they are familiar with. Because hitting people over the head with theory, all it does is just brings about a glaze in the eyes. while actually trying to understand the challenges they are struggling with. And then talking in the language that they are using themselves is very, very important. So yes, I take your point, yes. You need to speak up a bit, and so maybe bring this a bit closer to you.
I was just going to say, regarding the academic accessibility, a lot of the interviews that I've conducted with managers in secondary care, I've realised that they don't really read journals, and that's mostly what we do. No, so I think there's a big thing about dissemination strategies and how we actually, you know, get to that level. Because they just don't have time most of the time. And even to come to talks and things like that, it's rare, I think.
Great, thank you. Now I'd like to invite our two speakers if they have any comments or not.
The notion that we read journals is
you know, I mean, with respect, is amusing to us. I read two, but I'm unusual, I think. I think it is about where we're at. Yes. It's about coming in with a process, a set of support systems, not necessarily the answer, but meeting us where we're at, which is certainly what happened with Cell Success. Mm-hmm. We met people where they were, worked with them where they are, and then led into it, but using their vocabulary. Yeah. I just know it was hard for me, as somebody who reads lots of models. I think complexity theory, I suppose, as somebody who doesn't think she does science, really, there's that component to it as well. There is something about it that feels harder to get into. So I just think it has to somehow be made easier, perhaps more so than other things.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think not just easier in making the language simpler, but also contextualizing it, is providing that context that people are familiar with that makes a difference. Any?
I was chatting to somebody in the coffee break about eureka moments.
Ah, yes.
and reflecting on how I learn things, and you know, I learn things first at a superficial level, and they have to grab me, and so that's when, you know, kind of the journey starts. But actually, then I'm looking for something that's more challenging and which forces me into a deeper level of understanding. You know, perhaps I've kind of brought together a number of surface phenomena in that first stage, but understanding how they fit together or having a sense of that is the next stage. And so I think it isn't, you know, it isn't one thing and it isn't one level, and we're all really on a journey towards getting down to the depths where we really do understand it in the way that this lady does, who's been working with it for, I don't know, 16 years, did you say, something like that. And you can't expect to get there overnight. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you're interested in pursuing that journey, then you need, you know, the insights and the explanations of someone who's further along the road than you are. So that's not to say that practitioners are going to kind of take the whole of that journey, but what we want them to see is that actually there are better ways of explaining the world that they're living in than, if you like, the formal mechanistic systems, and that if you take that on board, that other explanation, then you can be more effective in achieving the outcomes you're trying to achieve.
Yes. I think what both of you made a comment which very much resonated, which was, is working with reality the way it is. And I think that's the whole point. Reality is complex. We as humans try to simplify it, and in doing so, we lose a lot of the richness of that reality. And what complexity theory does very well is to provide an explanatory framework for that complex reality, and that it's a part of its strength. Yes, Julian.
Yes, something I've thought about while I was on my PhD for many years is that To make it more... I don't need that, it's right, I don't think.
Okay.
To make it more accessible is something like grounding it in our own people's experience. I've been to many, many conferences where they've talked about co-evolution and new order and feedback, but it always seems to be very abstract. So, I mean, we could spend half an hour here now looking at, you know, is there co-evolution in this room right now? I mean, grounding it in real experience. Yeah. You know, talking to leaders, and if they, you know, if they did certain behaviours, did that create or enable or constrain a system to give them a flavour of, you know, what is actually a behaviour that would create self-organisation? Yes. So, I mean, it's, you know, it always seems to me a bit of a gap.
Yes.
Grounding it in real experience.
Yeah. One of the things that Julian does, and the way we used to work together, is he used to sit with our research group while we were doing our group analysis and actually draw some of the challenges as he saw them. Now, the beauty of that is that our brains cannot hold at the same time the multiple dimensions of a complex problem, but we can see it. So a picture actually captures the multidimensionality of a complex problem. And then the next point is use it as a step towards dialogue. And I remember very clearly in one organization, it was a horribly dysfunctional organization, and the whole thing was really falling apart. Now, there's no way that you can stand up and say to the chief exec, you have a terribly dysfunctional organization. So we put Julian's picture up, a sort of poster size, while we were having coffee. And as you can imagine, to begin with, you know, sort of icy silence until someone sort of recognized what was being depicted, and then they laughed, that broke the ice, and then they started talking about it. Once they started talking about it, we had permission to also discuss it. But it was using an unusual tool, which was a picture, to actually depict something that was not expected, because people expect a PowerPoint presentation, they don't expect a poster up on the wall. So, you know, that's one of the things we try to do. Use unusual, unexpected tools and multiple tools, because it isn't just one thing. I know modeling experts would say that modeling is the only thing in life, but I would disagree.
Simon Webb, as a slightly flippant remark, but it goes to a more general question about where do senior public service leaders learn from in general, as well as about complexity theory. I would offer two routes, really, of a pragmatic kind. I think I really recommend ingratiating yourself with economists, who are by far the preeminent academic discipline in government decision making across whole swathes of the sort of social and obviously economic parts of government. And the one place you're likely as a senior civil servant to take a bit of advice about a new idea is from your chief economist. So get hold of the MSc courses taken by the economist heading for central government and get it in there, would be my first thing. It's interesting that both LJ and I learned about this when we were loaned out to an American institution, which is where I heard about it first, and she did too. Both. And so the security and resilience and all that sphere of police and sphere of government. The good news there is that the senior people do training, so you can get into the military staff colleges and the police college, actually, if you try, and without too much effort, strangely enough. But the slightly preachy point is don't just sit and, you know, fret about why nobody listens to you, but go and find where people learn. Josh, I've got the microphone. I warned Sue I'd ask her this question, which is she was encouraging about the trends in those parts of government which deal with a slightly closed, if I might say so, slightly closed system within Britain of social service delivery, which is its own world of people, and there's some success has been achieved in getting people to move around in it. But what are the two other big groups of people in government? One are the people who work in the international organisations, where you have to deal with complexity of that strange body called an international body. You know, try, you know, anything from the UN to the FIFA. And how do you deal with them in this context? Or the perhaps more worryingly, the bit of government which deals with business, the sort of axis which deals with financial services, businesses in the economy. Have we got any real understanding of complexity in that kind of context question, you know, increase manufacturing in the British economy, you know, would they know where to start?
Thank you. That's a very good set of comments and questions. And I'll invite now both our speakers to respond.
Okay.
Who would like to go first?
I was sort of reflecting a bit because you, just as we came through the door back in, you said, I'll just give you a hint about what I'm going to say. You made me think really about, you know, how we got into the regulatory failure banking crisis that is the cause of so much distress at the moment. So it's not an answer to your question about manufacturing, how we support manufacturing. Mm. Although, you know, there probably are good answers on that. But what I suppose my thoughts are is that, and being a kind of 1960s, early 1970s political sociologist, I read Herbert Marcuse at the time. What seems to have happened is some sort of hegemonic entity taking over the apparent free thinking, highly intellectually capable Treasury. And no doubt BIS connected with that in some way. I suppose, you know, I expect from the economists and the financial experts in government public interest thinking that would have in some way dealt with the regulatory failure problem that we suffered. And I wonder why that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it's, you know, the very interpenetration of the world of Whitehall and wider public service that I am saying is helpful in achieving better outcomes in public service is also problematic if it involves a failure to actually work in the public interest of a crucial bit of the system. Now, I'm not saying they weren't aware of the problems of the financial sector and over-leveraging and all those things, but there was a kind of de facto decision-making to let it rip mm-hmm. and let the bubble go because everybody benefited from that, didn't they? I just think that I expect more of the cream of the nation's talent who go into the Treasury than to get it so wrong. And there are all sorts of inexplanations. Oh, we're just the servants of our ministers, all that stuff. But actually, as you know, better than anyone, because you've been in those high positions, they didn't just recruit us and train us all these years just to be the servants of our ministers. They also put us through that development process so that we could speak truth unto power. And actually make that professional contribution that ought to lead to better policy making than in that case it actually did in case of regulatory policy. So is that was too much interdependence, too much closeness, or that not enough people from other interests were involved in that Whitehall city hegemonic relationship? I suspect it's, you know, the closeness is okay, provided there are other interests mm-hmm. and influences in there, and that that's what was missing. It was too close to society and not open enough to wider influences on how it might happen. So it's a very good question to warn us of the dangers of interdependence when actually some of the things that we want to achieve are through the creation of Chinese mm-hmm. walls. Manufacturing industry, a bit more difficult. Mm-hmm. I'll pass on that one.
All right.
An unstudied subject, if I may say,
yes.
That the financial failure is only one of the four players has yet conducted a study of what went wrong.
Yes, we definitely need to look at that. In passing, some years ago, I interviewed the deputy director of the Bank of England. When we finished the interview and I switched the recorder off, I said, can I please be rather provocative now that we're not on record? And I said, why do you use such simplistic tools when the economy is a very complex system? And he turned around and he said, it's not a question I can answer, but we do have a room full of very highly qualified PhDs who are doing all sorts of modeling. And I said, are they doing any kind of, for example, agent-based modeling or any other? And he said, no, as far as he was aware at the time. So I think I will stop there. But I think it's part of our thinking that, again, we think too simplistically and address a complex challenge in a way that it is not appropriate. And I can give you endless examples of that kind of approach, of global organizations with highly intelligent people, but because they think in a particular way, they keep on addressing their complex issues in a very simplistic linear way.
I can just give a perspective from being in biz now and working with ministers. An ex-secretary of state from Biz, Labour, made it quite clear that the one thing that all the Labour ministers had said they'd got wrong was they listened to the civil servants too much. And that is clearly influenced in Biz behaviours at the moment. And it's completely different going to meet with ministers and the role that the civil servants now have, because they are there as the servants. They're there as intelligent servants and they get dialogue, but it's a completely different relationship. In terms of regulation, what is interesting now is the discourses about Vince Cable has given a clear edict that it isn't for any organisation now to have to prove why regulation takes or what gets taken away. It's for the civil servants to prove why any regulation should be there at all. And that's right across the Biz remit. So it's a completely different discourse. Now, I've got a meeting tomorrow with very senior civil servants from Biz, and I'm going to ask them, because I'm not sure whether that's coming from a complex analysis of anything, or it's coming from simplistic Victorian values. And that's the thing that people like me are trying to work out at the moment. We're certainly getting more freedom. We're certainly getting more autonomy. They want us to do it yesterday. So there's a real pressure, but that's life for politicians. But what we're trying to work out is this new way forward something for the future, or is it just going back to the past? And I still don't know. But I'm going to ask them tomorrow about dinner complexity theory.
Now, I will give Greg warning, because I would like him to comment on the economy side. So if you'd like to take that, I'll just
so that I'm not in your way.
Thank you. Actually, just sort of following up on the Biz point, sort of round off the theme, if you like. I mean, I knew going from central government that I didn't know that much about business. I didn't realise how much I didn't know until I began dealing with and working inside business. And in a sense, part of the trouble is the lack of complexity, the lack of interaction. Mm. People don't understand what it is like outside of the Whitehall Village, and there's very little reason to, and in the case of some departments, there's very good reason not to be sort of too exposed to the outside. And there's political nervousness as well in some instances, because can you really trust these civil servants not to, you know, speak their own mind? So there are quite understandable constraints behind that. But I wonder if there is an opportunity for complexity to play a role here, particularly when it comes to matters of scale. Mm-hmm. Because picking up on Simon's point about you know, who do you pick the phone up to talk about, if you're an industrialist, say, for example, you're the chief exec of Toyota, mm-hmm. and you've got trouble in Sunderland, on Gateshead, and mm-hmm. those local authorities have their own regional challenges. And the impetus from DCLG at the moment is to say everything is going to be pushed down locally. We're not going to intervene from the centre. You must resolve things within the LEPs yourselves. But if I'm the chief exec and I want something sorted, I'm not going, and that isn't working, how much time am I going to waste? And similarly, if I'm the local MP or even in number 10, what risk am I going to take with those jobs migrating elsewhere? So I think what complexity perhaps could add is an understanding of where those touch points are, flash points are, and also the gaps. Mm. And with the growth of emphasis on SMEs and smaller businesses, organisations like the CBI, for example, the bulk of their membership is small companies. Mm. I didn't know that. I assumed that it was all the big boys and the large corporates, but it isn't. And I think there is a room, perhaps, for a complexity-based visual to show a different kind of map to help people, not least busy ministers, as well as bureaucrats who have inevitably fallen into the idea that presenteeism is productivity, to get them into that different place and out from behind their desks and to Bradford and other places to see and experience differently what it feels like outside of that village. And complexity, I think, could help with that.
Right. Thank you. Can I pass it to you?
Sure.
Are you going to take the chance?
No, yeah. I'll say something.
By the way, the reason why we record is because we put the seminars on our website, and you have a wonderful resource because there are seminars going down literally back to 92. And therefore, do have a look at the website because they are there, and some of them are even video recorded. When we have the budget, we video record. So that's the reason why I record, so that it is there on the website for everyone else to see around the world, particularly in countries where they don't have, you know, this wonderful luxury that we have today.
Thank you, Eve, for putting me on the spot. So, for those who don't know me, I worked at the Bank of England for 9 years, straight from Cambridge Economics. So, I'm a trained economist. Bank of England 9 years. I then worked for a hedge fund for 3 years, and then sort of spent some time learning about complexity science. For the past year or so, I've been the chief economist of a think tank called Res Publica, which is quite close to the government. Until 2 weeks ago, that is when I finished there. The economics community suffers from what I think a number of people in this room would understand: lock-in. Okay, it is. And I try and choose my terms carefully. It's a very reductionist discipline and attracts people who think in a reductionist way, okay? Or to put it another way, it's a psychotic discipline that attracts people with psychosis. And I'm a trained economist, so I'm happy to say this. I'm overgeneralising massively to people listening on the web. going in and actually intervening directly and sort of teaching these people would be a great idea. I think the one thing we miss in the economics community is firm governance. Okay, Karl Popper wrote that the job of a scientist is to theorise, then test their theories against empirical evidence, and when the theory doesn't work against the empirical evidence, is go back to the drawing board. The economics community, I'd say 95% of them don't do that. They kind of miss that feedback loop. What the community requires is some form of governance, some form of body that says, you have failed. Okay, this free market thing, okay, has pretty much failed. You need to go back to the drawing board and start all over again. Okay, that's what we need in the economics community, and we need it from an external body like the government, frankly. Anyway, I hope too many people, the economists listening across the web weren't too offended by that.
Okay. Do we have any other? Okay. Let me go to someone who hasn't spoken yet. In fact, I was about to call you if you hadn't put your hand up.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to the point of, you said change fundamentally the thinking of, you know, as people in education. And I'm going to use the analogy of a project and a program. I do programs of change in organizations where if you get the wrong sponsor, and the sponsor that doesn't accept risk or can't understand uncertainty or is fearful, then you end up with a program that doesn't deliver. Because they're thinking of a program potentially as a series of projects, which it is, but they're not looking at the risk in a way. So it started me thinking, well, how do I get the right sponsor or the right team? And the way to look at it in some respects is to look at the psychological capability of the individual to think in an uncertain way or to manage complexity. Because if, you know, what makes a brilliant FD hopefully, and maybe that might answer the financial economic sort of questions, are very different characteristics that will make a brilliant artist or a creative or, you know, do innovation. And you can't change the kind of the makeup of the person. You know, it comes with their background, it comes with, you know, the things that they've been exposed to. So it's how you get that balance, I would suggest, and how you actually, perhaps, if you are to look at education, and I put this back to anyone here, you know, the acceptance of non-linear as well as linear, the acceptance of being able to leap to something and not know how to explain it, which is why I ended up kind of in kind of being not quite pushed out, but being sort of rather a distraction at times. But actually, just, you know, being based on trust and other values and other things that you know are people just absorb in an intuitive way. So I suppose putting it back to the speakers and maybe yourself, even anyone in the room, you know, can you put a framework in place? I've certainly got a very simple framework which uses a bit of Myers-Briggs, and I have three classifications of A, B, and C. I want people going from very linear to non-linear, and also a series of questions. But how do you get that into education, and how do you get that into kind of the organisations you go in? Because the other thing that affects it is people's ability to manage and tolerate risk. Yes. If people are wanting to be safe, you'll have less complexity, or you'll have the wrong risks being logged, and therefore you're actually looking at the wrong risks, you're not looking at the right risks. Yes. Anyway, I've spoken too much. Thank you.
Try and come to the 29th. I think you'll find the landscape of the mind framework interesting. There was someone else. Yes.
Well, I'm getting terribly.
Have I? No. There we go.
I just wanted to go back to the question that you posed at the beginning, Lynn. One of the ways that I found I can get people interested in complexity is to talk about emergence and contingency. And by talking about emergence, what I usually try and do is get them engaged in non-emergence, because we often, if I'm going to talk to people, it's because they've got change projects that they haven't been able to manage themselves that have failed, and their inquiry into that is just often, well, we blame somebody and we moved on, and here you are, and in 6 months we'll blame you. So just getting people interested in why things don't emerge and why things don't change and what's underneath that gets them into inquiry. It disrupts that kind of blame and that reactivity, and let's move on. And if you can hold them in that kind of long enough, then they discover that actually there's a complex adaptive system here. I think then people like the idea that it's contingent, that their history and that their experience is important in the story. And then usually what happens is you've disrupted the reactivity, so you can get people connecting with the system. The other thing I often find is that people are in disconnected cultures. They actually don't talk to each other. So if you can then get permission to actually connect people together, the other problem then is that they're not interested in the theory that underpins what you're doing. They kind of get into the problem-solving process, and you get back to what somebody was talking about, I think, earlier around flow. And that's what experiencing living well in a kind of complex adaptive system, I think, is, if that's kind of helpful contribution.
Great, thank you very much.
I'd love to respond a little bit to that, if I may, because yes. You're talking about diversity being a central part of complexity, and you were talking about different types of people. If I can be very challenging, can I suggest that this concept of very intelligent that was used earlier on is a very slippery concept? Perhaps I'll refine that by those people are those that succeed in a specific system at a specific time. I'm then suggesting that those same people go back in to teach the next generation. So there's a very strong self-selection going on, I think. So you've got the leaders with certain types of characteristics, and they also then choose universities or whatever which reinforce those characteristics, and of course the lecturers there also reinforce those. So there's something like that. It's actually behaving like a very complex system, but without the diversity.
Yes, yes. And you also get the lock-in that Greg...
Yes, okay, mentioned. Absolutely, because that's locked in. And how on earth do you actually disrupt that?
There's too much invested in the system as it is.
Absolutely.
And that is a part of the reason why you can't change it.
That's right.
Okay.
Difficult.
I just wanted to
just leave it down here.
Sorry, I can't remember your name at the moment, although I've got your card, but the circus lady and I were discussing the elephant in the room. And indeed, there are no elephants in her circus. So we were using the metaphorical concept. And it's quite... I think it's quite interesting how many organisation development people are here, and I've that's part of my own background as well. Sort of this is a way of saying, in other words, what was said at the back, that part of what you can do as an organisation development person is to help organisations listen to their silences and to understand the many different frames of reference that the many different actors in an organisation will have, which stop them communicating, and which, you know, through your offices you can kind of create a meta language through which they can connect and which the elephants can be talked about. But it seems to me, I absolutely agree, if you don't have I've never had a good enough client, actually, in my consultancy life. Damn, you know, if only the clients were good enough, it would be all right, wouldn't it? But I think that, obviously shaping your client from where they are when you start to where you need them to be for their real needs to be met is part of the skill, isn't it? And it doesn't fit terribly well with certainly government procurement systems for that work, where you have to know the answers from the beginning in order to, et cetera, et cetera. But that notion of working in the space between people to help them see the richness of their common or collected knowledge in order to solve their problems is, I think that's why the OD people in the room are interested in complexity, because actually that's what you do. That's what I used to do. That's the living reality of what that consultancy offering is. And it's terribly hard, and nobody thanks you for it, do they? Because, you have to give all the credit to them rather than to you.
I'll take one more question, then I'll come back to you, Lynn.
So I used to be part of a group called the Institute for Collapsonomics, and we had a term which ties together some of the economics issues with the black elephant. With the elephant in the room, which is black elephant. And the black elephant is the elephant in the room which will be passed off as a black swan after it explodes. And this is, in terms of the regulatory failure that we saw in finance, this is actually black elephant. Everybody knew that risk culture had infected the UK financial system from America, and everybody said, and then it went bang, and everybody said, one in a billion. The other thing I wanted to pick up on was this thing about complexity and governance. And, of course, the entire Cold War landscape was shaped by what we'd now recognise as being an information theory and complexity read from a guy called George Kennan. Do you know this guy? Right. So he wrote a thing called The Long Telegram, which was officially called On the Origins of Soviet Conduct or something like that, where he argued that the Soviet Union was inevitably going to collapse because of the inefficiencies in information flow caused by a command economy, and that if we could keep the Soviets contained, eventually that would result in the collapse of their society. And the entire policy of containment was based on this complexity theoretic read. So I think the fact that we've had one enormous foreign policy victory from complexity is something that in the field people are not really making enough of. Like, we got that one right, and maybe we should start looking at some of the other problems. I'm doing a lot of work right now on a thing called goat rodeos. And a goat rodeo is a situation where you've got a diverse set of actors from different domains, NGOs, military, government, civilians, with divergent goals trying to operate together to solve a problem. And, I'm just going to throw this out as a research topic. I think that goat rodeos are structurally insoluble, even with the best facilitation in the world. Move that there.
I just want to end on the education point, because I think you asked a really interesting question there. I personally think there is enough theories, approaches, developmental ways that actually education could be totally revolutionised, that we could completely change it. Well, I'm just completing a PhD module with the Institute of Education on policy and post-16 compulsory education, and one of the things they were saying in the last session was it's the most
played with. There's been more initiatives in this area, but actually it's virtually stayed the same. You've still got A-levels as the gold standard, you've still got your three-tier system, etc., etc. So my sense is, until the system of education, as per the system of capitalism, if you're looking at the finance side, shifts in a way that it will allow it. It's all there already in place. You could revolutionise it tomorrow, but the rewards of a system that's still where A-level is the gold standard and university is, so it won't shift, because what the teachers on the ground say, there's no space for anything but the subject matter for all the curriculum. I've tried, like anything, in colleges to introduce learning to learn or Guy Glaxton stuff, which I adore, and it's really hard because teachers are obsessed with getting them through. Yes. So it's where you actually make that intervention. Exactly. That shifts the whole system.
Yes, I think I was going to come to you now.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to that, because a lot of the work that I'm doing is exactly that. It's in schools, and it's saying, how do we fundamentally shift the system? Because I think one of the things that the kind of unspoken elephants in the room are around, it's around power. Who holds the power? What are we educating our young people for? Who gets to be, in the latter years, the controllers of power, and who gets to be those who are controlled by those of power? So I think that there's something about kind of listening to some of the earlier comments and then thinking, I think that's right. And we're working, especially in education and in school education, with a system that there's a huge amount of investment in keeping the status quo. And, you know, a lot of the teachers that I speak to, the heads that I speak to, a lot of them will say, yes, you know, it would be fantastic, Ilana, to have, you know, thinking around what is the purpose of education and how are we fundamentally shifting our education and are we preparing our young people for an incredibly different, you know, future and world than what education was originally structured for. And, you know, you look at Ken Robinson's work and but fundamentally there's something about the education system is very stuck, because there's a lot of investment in keeping it stuck. And people and systems in power have a very big investment in holding it the way it is. So I think there's something for me around how we add and acknowledge those complexities in very complex systems already, and then work with that. And one of the things I wanted to just add to that is that I think that there is a growing, on the positive side, I think that there is a growing movement of people, of heads, of educationalists, of people in education who are beginning to think differently and who are saying we need to be revisioning the purpose of our education, and we need to be revisioning what and how we are educating our young people for the future, and that they will be co-creating with us. Yeah. And so I think there is hope. But I think it's that point, Eve, that you were talking about. You know, it's 30 years. It's time. It's, you know, it's that longitudinal look, which is frustrating when you want it to be different now.
Oh, yes.
So you were talking, I was thinking of my friend Michael Bichard, who was also my boss recently at the Institute for Government, and kind of having talked to him quite a lot about this, observing his journey from being permanent secretary at the Department for Education and Employment, where along with the Secretary of State, then Secretary of State David Blunkett, they knew the right answers. They knew that what needed to be done was to, you know, break the autonomous power of teachers, national curriculum, strengthen Ofsted, those things in that old recipe. And, you know, first signs of the results of that were promising, promised early on to break the pattern of, you know, the long tail of underachievement, which is the key feature of the UK secondary education system. But looking back over that whole period since then, he now thinks, it's hard for him to admit he was wrong, maybe he wasn't wrong at the time, but thinks that it was a partial solution for a period, but actually it didn't go. It didn't allow the system to move into kind of self-improving, learning from experience, moving up a picture that you're just talking about in your optimistic scenario. So I think that, you know, as people live through, try the recipes that are there to hand, find that they're only partially successful and that they're limited, then they're forced to look for new ways of dealing with the world. And I think your illustration is a really good one.
Thank you. There's a very interesting paradox, actually, between what we self-organization and leadership. Because in one sense, we want to facilitate self-organization at the local level, while at the same time, we also need a strong leader who will help to break through the old paradigm. And it's that tension all the time, which I think it's essential.
Thank you. I'd like to respond to what Sue was saying about OD and OD being able to focus on the gaps and the spaces and what's going on between, but also pick up what's been said about governance and risk management. I use the metaphor of the fish tank, and help senior managers see that they fail to see beyond the fish. They become obsessed with the fish and the performance of the fish and the skills of the fish and the training of the fish, and their gaze doesn't help them see what they're expecting the fish to swim in. And if you can help them see that there's a fish tank there, and at times they're in the fish tank, and examine what it is that's surrounding all the fish and going on between them, which includes things like the climate of fear, all the toxicity, and can consider what's the challenge for the fish in navigating themselves, their route for the organisation through this rather murky environment, and who's contributing the toxins, and to what extent are they responsible for the toxins, contributing them, but also having a responsibility for doing something about removing them. And which brings me to the question of governance and risk management, because when a system collapses because there is just so much toxicity, it's rarely clear that any senior executive accepts that he has a responsibility for the quality of the fish tank. And when people are looking for somebody to be held accountable, they're looking for the fish. And I do remember part of the probation service collapsed because the fish tank was so foul, but neither the chief executive nor the HR director recognised that they had any accountability, and nobody was holding them to account for looking after the health and well-being of the environment in which everybody was swimming. I gave some evidence to the when the city code was revised and they were looking at boardroom responsibilities under the heading of risk management. Nobody wanted to listen, but I was saying it would be helpful if there was clarification at the board as to where responsibility lay for the health and well-being of the system. Because I think that's something that is just overlooked, because people are just looking at the individual fish.
And it is that context which is absolutely critical.
Thank you. So if we're so on the subject of how to get the message across, particularly in the
in a sort of leadership area. These are just thoughts that occurred to me, so they're kind of comments, and please comment back if you want. I think the term leadership is a very abstract one. And you might have done this already, Lynn or Sue, but it would be good to sort of decompose that and sort of talk about different types of leadership. For example, I interact with a number of other people in society. You could have something called ethical leadership. I could be unethical or ethical. I have some, as an individual, I have some leadership capacity there because society co-evolves with me. Whereas you could talk about pattern recognition. And you could talk about vision and strategy as parts of being a leader. Maybe you've done this already in terms of sort of decomposing, but that's what I would do in terms of kind of discussing and trying to get the leadership, you know, complexity and leadership message across. Actually, the second point I was going to make is more of a question, which is, so one of the lessons I get from complexity is that society is constantly evolving. It's non-ergodic. You know, it changes inherently over time. So therefore, does that mean the nature of leadership changes over time as well?
Perhaps not the nature of leadership, but the characteristics necessary for leaders do need to change.
Thanks. Yeah. I guess I come from a background of sales and marketing, which may be slightly unusual in this room. And one of the things I learnt very early on about helping people to understand what it is I'm trying to sell was not to sell the complexity theory, but to sell what complexity can do for you. And I'm not sure that we get that message across strongly enough, to be honest. And I think also, and everything I'm hearing seems to suggest that actually being a leader who is working and living from a complexity perspective is difficult. You know, it's personally challenging. It requires you to, you know, be kind of emotionally and spiritually aware and growing and, you know, bringing those qualities and bringing that authenticity to what you're doing. And I don't think that's actually easy for many of us personally, never mind leaders. And again, I'm struck by my circus. I've been talking to a juggler recently about the difference between the perfect throw, which interestingly enough is a Russian approach to juggling, and the agile catch. And it's a very different style of juggling. And the jugglers who try to perfect the throw come from a very introverted place where they are completely focused on the perfection of the movement. The jugglers who are perfecting the agile catch have to be more aware of their audience and the environment in which they're working and the wind direction and the complexity of what they're doing, because their entire focus has much more of an adaptive approach to it. And I don't find it difficult to get leaders to understand the difference. What I find difficult is for them then to take forward the implications of the difference. And I think as someone up there was talking about, the power shifts, you know, the need to trust people, the willingness to do all of that. And it's not the understanding, to go to the heart of your question, it's not the understanding that I find is actually difficult. I think if you do ground it in some example, you can reach the understanding. It is providing the kind of motivation, first of all, of what complexity can do for you and why you should want to live out of that model. Supporting and facilitating and structuring the mechanisms by which the leader can develop the personal qualities to, you know, cope with ambiguity and read the patterns and do all those other things. So I'm not sure if that's an answer or a question, but my contribution.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Either of you want to comment before I take it to another?
I shall really take that away with me. I love that, the perfect throw and the agile yes. catch, I think. And in a way, that answers your question. I mean, the deconstruction of leadership, and I had 25 researchers from Lancaster University Business School who were all post-critical, post-modernists, who deconstructed us inside out, upside down. I used to say, when are you going to put us back together? Which they never seemed interested in doing.
So I had 4 years of a whole sort of community that was deconstructing leadership. And it's a really useful thing to do. So that whole notion of the heroic leader, distributed leader, followership, is one that I think in the leadership discourse is very active. I think what is happening, though, what happens in the leadership discourse is you hit times when the model that was there doesn't work for the issues that are now arising. And I do think we're in a space where people are saying it's harder than it's ever been. My experience of politicians in the moment and civil servants is they just know that they can't control it from the centre. What Sue was saying, it's a knowing that's not just in the head anymore. So that this is a time and an opportunity where juggling is a very useful metaphor, I think, in terms of it needs to be different and things are falling apart that never have before, so that there is an emerging space to experiment and play. But I think people often say to me, like, why would I go through all the stuff that you go through? Because I am a growth junkie, there's no doubt about it. But what I do find is they may do it in other parts of their life. My organisational life is as much my path as, and it's integrated for me. But what I do know is most people do their work at some point in their life, and their leadership isn't just a function. Leadership is also an identity. It's a collective. It's a social enterprise. It's all sorts of things. So I think people begin to do their work elsewhere, but I know hundreds of leaders who don't want to do the journey I've done. It doesn't interest them. And I still have that thing, you know, are complexity people born to the point that they start to do their stages of development? You know, was it my pre-birth trauma? Or was it the environment I was brought up in that makes that? Or is it something you can encourage people into? And I think it's a complete mix. But I think the complexity debate born or made is as relevant as the leadership debate on that.
But just also to come back to your point, because what can complexity offer, which I think it is also a language and a set of concepts that makes sense of the experience. When I mentioned that I interviewed the deputy director of the Bank of England, at the same time I had interviewed several chief execs of the FTSE 100, as well as very senior civil servants. None of them was familiar with complexity theory. The reason why they agreed to be interviewed was because they were intrigued. They really wanted to find out something a little more about it. When I heard the way that they approached leadership, the good ones actually were living it, but were not aware of the theory. And it was astonishing, because the moment we started the discussion, and I would say to them, what you're doing, I can explain in this way. And the reason why this works is because it was incredible. It gave them that next possibility, a tool that they were lacking, even though they were brilliant. They were amazing people. They still needed that explanation as to why did it work. That it wasn't just intuition. It actually had a theoretical basis for it, and it did make a huge difference. And I think that's what complexity theory also offers, is that set the language and the set of concepts, because it makes more real, it makes sense of what you think is only your experience.
I totally hear that, but they're already there. What about the ones who just can't work that way yet?
Right, okay.
Yeah, because they're the ones that worry me.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. And I must say, there are some people who get it and some who never will. I have someone already here, and I'll come back to you. Oops. Thank you. Actually, I wanted to pick up on Eve's point. You know, what can complexity offer is a fantastic framework, explanatory framework for things that some people already, I think, intuitively get,
But I wonder whether there's sort of some implicit assumptions that we're making, that if we enable organisations or systems to work as complex adaptive systems, we get better outcomes. And I think we need to be a little bit careful there, because I think with complexity theory, what we can say is we could get different outcomes, but not necessarily better. And I think maybe we're doing ourselves a disservice by actually sort of implicitly suggesting that there's something better about complexity, when real people in real organisations, you know, we're fearful. We feel fear that the different we might get might be collapse, it might be breakdown. You know, if that's what I do as a leader, how will I cope with it? What if I'm responsible for collapse, breakdown in a system? This could be, you know, this connectivity piece could be utterly scary. What if I was responsible for that? And I just wonder whether there's something we can do to acknowledge people's fears. You know, this is real fear, and of course that's you know, something important to pay attention to. And I wonder if paying attention to the shadow side could help us to introduce more people to the explanatory power of complexity.
Can I be brought up that point? Because we need to be a little evangelistic about it and think, see the very much the positive side. But the negative side is just as powerful. Al-Qaeda use very powerful networks, and that is why they are so resilient. And I think we need to remember that. It can be used both for good and evil. But at the same time, there is the shadow side. And exactly the same principles will bring about the catastrophe. Absolutely. So I think that's a very well-made point. Yes, Ed.
Okay.
Well, that's not my question. As the conversations flowed this afternoon, I was thinking of a quote from Samuel Beckett, where he said, fail often, but fail better. Now, I'm not suggesting that as a strategy for us, but you know, because when you're listening to other people, you're kind of wafting in and out of what's being said. We are struggling with a very unpredictable future, so there's a lot of unknowns that were not, which was not the situation perhaps 25, 30 years ago. And one of the areas that I'd just like both speakers to share their thoughts on is the emergence of the personalization agenda, which has been addressed in education and in social care and in health, and how other ways of supporting leaders as a social engagement, both in community and with organizations, might emerge. By that, focusing on the comments that you kind of made around self-organization, that was quite explicit in your presentation, Sue, and was alluded to in the communities of enterprise that you facilitated as a leader in action, in time, in place. And one of the I think real exciting opportunities is, how do we facilitate leadership in the new user-led networks that are now being resourced at a marginal rate, so that they are likely to fail because they don't have access to the kind of resource that we know they need in order to operate at mass scale? So I know that's a bit of a mouthful, but for me it's a sign that we make those connections through facilitating what can be integrated by ordinary people from the theory in their solving of daily practice with the resource that they have. And are we part of that resource for them as we move into the next 5-10 years?
Thank you. It is actually 1 minute before 5:30.
Sorry, I got that in right on time.
Yes, you did. So I will ask my speakers to give us 30 seconds each of concluding remarks.
I actually think you've just articulated a whole new arena of leadership for the future, which is absolutely critical. Colleges have always seen themselves as facilitators of leadership. And I just met with PwC recently because they've just got some massive contract to do this for emerging community leaders as well. I think eventually it will become mainstream. I think these pilots will produce things that will enable us to do it. And I do think Common Purpose, all the work that Julia does, all that kind of... I was at the Cabinet Office for 40 months, and when we looked at what new sorts of leadership really worked, that was the arena that was really, really showing promise and potential and excitement. So I haven't got much time, but I actually think that that is the edge of where it's going to be and it needs to be. Thank you.
Going back to, not to your question, but to an earlier point, but to an earlier one about what do we mean by leadership. The last 5 years I've worked in Whitehall, and a common use of the term in that context is people who occupy senior positions form the leadership. And so it's easy to know that's not right. And you know, I make cheap points at dinner parties about, you know, you're only a leader if someone's prepared to follow you. Rather than occupying a position. So that's a kind of starting point. But just, you know, kind of reflecting on some of the conversation this afternoon, it's not if someone's prepared to follow you, but if you're prepared to work in such a way that you create a dialogue that deals with issues, overcomes conflict, resolves it, and works towards common solutions. Can you really call yourself a leader in an age of complexity, I think, or leader in a complex adaptive system? And as the last person was speaking, I was thinking about my mum, who is 97 in 3 weeks' time, lives in Bradford, and is quite frail, although she has all her brain cells. And lots and lots of people work together to enable her to have as full and as rich a life as possible. She was in a community hospital about 6 weeks ago for a couple of weeks, and the, you know, kind of multiple professionals and her GP, who is a doctor in that community hospital, and the residential home in which she lives, all worked in one way or another to enable her to fulfil her mission to be herself still at that advanced age. And it's a good news story. It's about people out there working at that level who aren't thrown off their course or, you know, deflected from their purpose by how crap things are, but who carry on doing what they, you know, are there to do for user empowerment. She probably would never have... Well, she has got a personalised budget in that she gave up the cleaning contract that came with her flat in sheltered housing, which she now deploys herself to buy in extra support. But mostly things like that service that she needs are more effectively provided through some sort of public, voluntary, private partnership, and provided people work there with the aim of making my mum's life as full as it can be, that's as much as we can ask, really. And I think that's a fantastic thing to, in a civilised society, to happen. And so we must be doing something right somehow.
At that point, I'd like to thank both our speakers, but also thank everyone, because I think everyone has contributed wonderfully to this afternoon seminar. I hope that you leave by taking at least one
seed of a good idea with you. I think that I'd be satisfied if you just did that. And hope to see you again. And thank you all very much indeed.
So if you want to sort of sit and chat for a little while, do that. Patrick, don't sit here.
Sorry?
What did you do? I can't
retire. I'm Steve Lorraine. I've had a company for 10 years that's worked with leaders and managers and so on. But for 25 years prior to that, I was in local government.
Oh, really?
Doing very differently, but trying to do some things that you clearly achieve in very different range of services. And that's what I came across soon on a leadership program that I went on. And that's where I was first introduced to complexity. And I've kept with me ever since this need not to reduce the complex to merely complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
But to also get across to people that does not mean that I'm against action. It just means that I'm trying to understand. I'm trying to get people to understand that bigger frame. But thanks very much again. It's so lovely to see you again. All right, yeah, marvellous.
Thanks. It's gone well, hasn't it? This arm is really new. It didn't come over. No. No, but it was about how to pitch it. I was only reading my introduction to complexity theory 2 weeks ago.
I know. You're one chapter ahead of them. Or not in some cases.
That's when I got my thing about action, but I've been studying theories of complexity for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it was nice the way you facilitated the second half, I thought that really is good. The way you facilitated the second half of the afternoon.
What do you mean?
Well, she did.
Yeah.
I just want to say thank you. That was wonderful.
Thank you. Are you the consilient?
I'm the consilient person.
Because I was going to talk about, you know, A.O. Wilson's book.
Yeah,
consilient.
Well,
I was going to mention it, and I didn't. When you said that, I thought I wish I had.
Well, actually, I've stolen it from his name's gone out of my head. Richard Dawkins.
Oh,
so Richard Dawkins actually does a bit of a critique of E.L. Wilson, which is why all the emergence of contingents and stuff, because he bangs on about
consilience.
Yeah, well, I love it as well.
I was wondering what I had done with it.